Welcome to the Global Governance Podcast, where we explore the future of governance. Each episode will look at a different global issue and how governance plays a key role in its solution. From climate change to gender equality, from corruption to peace and security, we invite experts to explore a thought-provoking game of what if and why not, positing a world in much closer international cooperation. And now your host, Augusto López Claros. Enjoy.
Susana Malcorra became dean of the Instituto de Empresa School of Public and Global Affairs in March of 2020. She was also foreign minister of Argentina from 2015 to 2017 and was subsequently appointed as minister advisor by President Mauricio Macri, and in that capacity was the chairperson of the WTO ministerial conference hosted by Argentina in December of 2017. Dean Malcorra holds a degree in electronics engineering from the University of Rosario and has 25 years professional experience in business, having worked for IBM and served as CEO of Telecom Argentina. Dean Malcorra left Telecom in 2002 and joined the United Nations World Food Program, serving as Chief Operating Officer. In May 2008, she was appointed Undersecretary General for the recently created Department of Field Support, where she was charged with providing logistical, communications, personnel, and financial support services to peacekeeping operations. In April of 2012, Dean Malcorra was appointed Chief of Staff to the Secretary General. Thus, in addition to her long career as an executive, she has invaluable experience in the diplomatic field, from handling negotiations with various countries in the developing world to the approval by the General Assembly of strategic, financial, and budgetary matters. Dean Malcorra, thank you for accepting our invitation to participate in this podcast. We're privileged to have you as our guest, and thank you for taking the time to talk with us. If you don't mind, I would like to begin by exploring your professional development. Can you describe how you made the transition from electrical engineering to business management to diplomacy? What experiences were most important in this formation, and how do you think your background influences your approach to international issues?
Before going into the question, thank you for inviting me, Augusto. It's a real pleasure to be here, to have the opportunity to have this conversation and to share this conversation with your audience that hopefully will find it of interest. Regarding your question, I have to say that this is something that comes quite often when I engage in talks and in different events, because it is not very common to have somebody with a background of engineering, electronics engineering, moving into these other fields. And for me, it's almost natural. First of all, I find engineering to be a career that prepares you to have a critical mind, that prepares you to have a logic into how you assess problems and analyze questions, that is really a good base to start from to develop different angles of your future career, not necessarily the technical ones. So to me, that's the basis from which I started. Engineering gave me the tools to really be very strongly equipped to handle problems, to handle issues, which in a way is what I feel is my forte. So from there, I went into my business life, very close to engineering, starting in technology with IBM, then going in telecommunications, but honestly, never being very specific on the technical aspects of the work, because I was always more into people's relation, how to bring together teams, how to be able to address challenges through others by creating the team spirit. So that was the way I evolved, although, again, closer to the technical field that I was equipped with in my career. And then in 2001, the crisis hit Argentina, one of the many. This was a very serious one. And with that crisis, which brought a 300% devaluation of the peso, came the declaration of Telecom Argentina, which I was the CEO. You mentioned that. And it was the third largest company in Argentina, to have the need to declare Chapter 11, to recognize that technically, due to the devaluation, the company had come into Chapter 11. And I had the responsibility. This is a listed company in Wall Street, so I went to New York, London, Tokyo. It was a very, very difficult moment and a very difficult responsibility to communicate this to our debtors and to communicate that to the international community at large and to my own team, the people of Telecom. 22,000 people were working in the company at the time. And a few months later, the board decided that it was time to change the profile of the CEO from one who had more operational management expertise to one who had a financial background and was more prepared to handle a debt renegotiation, which was the survival element for the company. And of course, I had to go. It was a very disappointing moment because sometimes you realize that you can fail without being responsible for that failure, without being the cause of the failure, that you have to leave a project that for me was a very significant one, one that transformed my country from an infrastructure telecommunications perspective that brought internet, mobile phones, etc., and have to leave it for no reason of your own doing, but you had to leave it. So it was a very disappointing moment. And at that point, I said to my friends in the headhunting business that I really wanted to do something different, that I had it enough with the private sector, that I wanted to go to civil society and NGO, contribute from there to a cause that I will be interested in and help with my experience. And a little later came this notion of World Food Program, a UN institution, a UN organization that was looking for a Latin American woman. I didn't know at the time that in the UN, geographic representation matters, and gender also, because they wanted to balance better gender at the top level. So I went into that through a headhunting firm, and a few months later, I was called by the executive director and said, if you're still interested, it was quite a few months later, the job is yours. And that's how I got into the United Nations. But it's true that I went into the United Nations first in Rome, which is not a central place to the politics of the United Nations, to the dynamics of politics of the United Nations. Second, to an institution that is a humanitarian institution, the largest humanitarian institution of the UN system, an institution that clearly is more geared towards getting things done, geared towards operations than to the politics. And that sort of shielded me from the more nuanced aspects of the United Nations. And I started there, worked there, and step by step I became the interface between Rome and New York, and that exposed me to New York and exposed me to the internal politics, not only the larger politics, the internal politics of the UN. And I guess through that, I became known in New York, and it was through that that I got the offer to join peacekeeping, which was divided in two departments. And there, even though my department was a department of support, the logistical one, I became very closely engaged with the Security Council because of the notion of mandates of those missions being handled by the Security Council. So in that phase, I became acutely aware of the politics, the geopolitics, the dynamics between member states, between regions. And it was learning by experience, learning by doing. And 4 years later, when the Secretary General Ban Ki-moon was re-elected, he offered me to become his chief of staff, which is, without any question, the most political position within the system, having to handle the whole system. So that was my evolution. It was a natural evolution. It was something in which I have no doubt skills that my career gave me prepared me to handle many aspects, particularly this notion of the logic of analyzing problems, the notion of being very geared towards results, which I think is made an impact within the United Nations. But step by step, I grew into the more political aspects. And being the chief of staff of Secretary General Ban Ki-moon, I got a call from the then a candidate to become president, Mauricio Macri, who on the phone offered me, should he win, to become his foreign minister. So that's the long story of my evolution, which has one bottom line, I will say, and that is that you have to be prepared to change, you have to be prepared to reinvent yourself, and you have to be ready to take your chances to go into something that probably you are not totally equipped, but you dare take the responsibility because you care about what the job is about. So that's it.
I was delighted to learn in early 2017 that you had teamed up with former New Zealand Prime Minister Helen Clark and former UNESCO Director General Irina Bokova to set up the group Women Leaders for Change and Inclusion. I have often felt that the world bears a heavy burden in economic and security terms by the relegation of women to secondary roles in the management of world affairs. As you know, only 11% of the 193 members of the UN have a woman prime minister or head of state. Their participation on corporate boards is extremely low. And as we discovered in recent years at the World Bank, there are some 1,600 different forms of discrimination against women embedded in the laws of UN member countries across all regions of the world and all income levels. But you and Madams Clark and Bokova must have brought to bear your own unique experiences on these issues. Tell us a bit about what led you to this initiative and how do you and your colleagues think we can move to a world in which women are given more opportunities to display their talents and capacities?
Thank you, Gusto. Let me say that it is the group of women leaders, Voices for Change and Inclusion, and the notion of voices is very important because we are 54 now and each one of us has a voice of her own, can speak up and advocate for issues, but we feel that 54 coming together make those voices very, very significant and difficult not to pay attention. Just one little background here. Irina, Helen, and I competed to become Secretary General of the United Nations. So we were competitors, and we lost. At the time where everybody was given for sure that it was going to be a female Secretary General for the first time in 70 years of history. So we started to talk about this notion of doing something around gender, and we felt that the three of us founding it together will make a significant impact because we had competed with each other, but still we were able to come together and work together, which is exactly what we did in the United Nations first and what we are doing here through GWL, Voices for Change and Inclusion. What is different from our group regarding other, many other groups that work for gender questions. We deeply believe that gender, the advancement of gender, the empowerment of women has been associated to the United Nations, to the multilateral system. That Beijing and what came after Beijing was significant to put pressure on member states to advance a gender agenda. That the peer pressure that takes place every March when member states meet to see how things are evolving was key to enact many very important policies in different countries, but not enough, far from enough. And that the fact that the multilateral system is under siege, is under pressure, has a direct bearing to the gender agenda, which in our view is also moving backwards. It's under huge pressure to move backwards through the misrepresentation of what gender means to the world. This notion that gender, that women's rights are somehow opposed to family rights, that is really very much into the minds of certain groups. So for us, this connection, the fact that we were able, with our backgrounds, all of us, the 54, have a background in the UN system at large, the UN system and all its affiliated bodies. And the fact that we all care about gender gives us an angle to go into issues of different nature that is unique, and raising our voices together makes us advocate of this issue. So that's how we came about with the idea, and how it is that we are working. We are 54 now, but most likely with two more colleagues coming on board very soon, we'll be 56.
The last few years have brought multiple challenges to international institutions and multilateralism. Some would say we are in a moment of transition in global leadership. In a recent article you wrote with Bruce Jones for Brookings, you argue that there is no return to the US-led multilateral cooperation of the 1990s and early 2000s. Instead, you describe a framework for what you characterized as multilateral competition, with a large emphasis on forging cooperation through middle powers. Can you elaborate on these arguments and vision, and what reforms would be needed to make such an order possible?
Well, in first place, Bruce from Brookings and myself from IE are working on the evolution of multilateralism. You're right. Our first paper refers to what you just said, the multilateralism in competition. And of course, it's in competition essentially a geopolitical competition between China and the U.S. That sets the stage for something that is not conducive to agreement and to finding solutions. So that's why we indicate that it's largely competitive and driven by competition, and that competition can produce, if you so wish, an environment where you compete but you still live together, or an environment where you compete and that leads to a confrontation. And there is a significant risk at this moment that we move into an environment of confrontation, serious confrontation, that might be caused by mistake. You know, it doesn't necessarily mean that by design this is the case. And there is where we feel that middle powers have a significant role to play, both in terms of safeguarding the multilateral system that we know, the multilateral order that we know. In fact, we talk about order, not system, because we believe it goes beyond the institutions. And that in doing so, there are different approaches that you can have. One of them is based on values, and particularly based on the notion of democracy, which is so much at risk these days, and in which China represents a different model, but the U.S. has democracy itself at risk within the country. So maybe there is a concerted effort by middle powers to safeguard those principles within the system and create anchors of issues in which they agree to start working together, although there might not be all member states involved. Even the two large ones might not be involved initially. So that's one approach. Another approach is to talk about the global public goods, which have been so much postponed in the past 10 plus years, I would say, probably 20 years, in which, and the pandemic, the COVID pandemic puts this into value, you know, how little attention has been given to the tools necessary to manage a global effort like a pandemic. So have member states associating themselves around certain public, global public goods that could have an impact that will then build back trust into the multilateral system. Because part of the problem is that citizens have distanced themselves from governments, have distanced themselves from democratic institutions, and in doing so, have distanced themselves from multilateral organizations and institutions that are even farther away from them. So working on global public goods is another way to solve problems that do have an impact on people. So there are different ways to approach this. We believe that the U.S. will not come back, as you said, to being the police of the world that used to be, that so many resented, that so many embraced, that in the end, everybody was hoping to have that policing role of the U.S. That is not going to come again. And we need to find a guard, a safeguard, and that can only be met by these middle powers. And here there is something essential, middle powers that cannot be Western only, that have to represent the variety of views, of cultures, of perspectives of all over the world, and the rebalance of power that represents middle powers from the South. So that is something that we are working on in order to present more concrete proposals that should be coming rather soon.
Thank you, Susana. That sounds very interesting and insightful. Let me sort of shift gears a little bit and ask you to share your views with us on the future of the United Nations. You know that last year, both you and I participated in many events and discussions organized in connection with the 75th anniversary of the UN Charter. With many others, we celebrated many of its achievements and also, of course, could not help noticing its many failures, the most important of which is perhaps the collective inability of its members to modernize the organization and turn it into a problem-solving institution at a time when it's evident that the multiple global challenges that we face, climate change, widening income disparities, an unsettled international security situation, and the return of the arms race of the Cold War, all of these problems, you know, do not admit solutions outside of a framework of much stronger international cooperation. My question to you, Susana, is will the global order which emerged in 1945 be overwhelmed by the crises that are coming our way? I'm thinking in particular of climate change and all of its associated calamities. Or do you think, in fact, that our leaders have the political will to make the necessary changes and reforms now before it's too late? I realize this is a difficult question to tackle, but I will be most interested in your insights.
Well, there is no doubt that the United Nations has many achievements that we can discuss and has failures too. I mean, it seems like if you recognize that there are shortcomings, that goes against the notion of the institution. I think all institutions that are the product of human beings coming together, no doubt, will have also shortcomings. But all in all, I think that the fact that the United Nations exists has improved largely the way we live in this world. But it's also true that the challenges we face now are of different nature and require different institutions, different tools within the United Nations. Let me just give you an example. The question of globalization and the question of companies becoming global has a huge bearing, and you know this much better than me, Augusto, on taxes. Well, shouldn't the United Nations, shouldn't an institution within the large United Nations system be looking into that and be proposing solutions? Because this is essential to be able to reduce inequality and be able to reassign resources in a proper way. Well, that is to me one element that we are missing today in the United Nations. True, the G20 has now addressed this. The United States, President Biden has brought this to the forefront, and now we are talking about a 15% tax. I don't know whether a 15% tax is the right, but at least the right point to discuss, but at least it's clear that things are starting to move. There are many, many issues like this that the United Nations and some kind of composition within the United Nations should be addressing, and it's not there. I couldn't agree more with you. There is a question of leadership, of willingness from the leaders to bring this and put it on the table. There is a notion of short-term perspective that doesn't allow many of these conversations to take place. This idea that democracies and democratic leaders face every 2 years somehow the referendum on what they do, and the fact that citizens do not necessarily value what the multilateral system contributes to, I think is starting to prove a big problem, because these issues that require leadership, very often there we lack the leaders to invest in them in the long term. So I associate very much this issue with the problem of immediate result, immediate satisfaction that our societies are immersed with, and the difficulties that democracy is facing, because all of those things come together to really take the decisions that are needed to produce the changes that are needed, which are multiple in multiple arenas, and that need to reflect not only the balance of power of today, but also the issues that we really care about and affect our, not only our present, more importantly, our future.
Thank you, Susana. That's very thoughtful. I wanted to ask you, at the UN, you played a central role in the organization's response to the West African Ebola emergency. And one can imagine that you must have thought long and hard about COVID-19 and its aftermath, during the past year and a half. I hope you will agree with me that maybe it's not too early to draw some lessons from this, very severe crisis. In my own work, I have tended to focus on what the crisis says about the current system of economic governance. But it seems to me there are broader lessons as well, that have a bearing on issues of international cooperation, the role of the World Health Organization and the multilateral development banks and so on. Please share with our audience, given your very rich background in the UN system, your views on what we have learned from this crisis and how to help us avoid the next pandemic, or at least mitigate its impact. Because the scientists, as you know, are saying that we will have, you know, further pandemics into the future.
Well, first of all, I do not believe that there was a global response to COVID. And you know, often you hear people talk about the global pandemic, and that is absolutely unacceptable. A pandemic is by nature global, and it requires a global response. And that hasn't happened. It is a combination of member states looking inwards, looking through the lens of their territory, which if there is something that a virus doesn't respect, is a territory, boundaries. And WHO doesn't have the right pressure points to be able to really have the ability to present global responses. Let me just briefly mention, you talk about Ebola. That was a very interesting example. It was something that did not become a pandemic. It was restricted to a region. But when the Western world described that it could be transferred to both Europe and the United States, there was a decision to have a response to at least contain it in the region, and in containing it, making sure that you put a stop to it. And there was a response that was coordinated. There was a concerted effort. None of that occurred with the pandemic, with the COVID pandemic. So to me, it's clear that there is no way we are going to address future pandemics, which experts say that with climate change and the many things that the human beings are doing to the earth will occur more and more often. And by the way, Augusto, let me add something here. I don't know why this pandemic caught us by surprise. It was clearly stated in the many alerts the WHO had prepared that pandemics were very high risk and likely to happen in the coming 5 to 10 years, not sometime in the future. When you look into the risk assessment of countries of really significance, where risk assessments are prepared seriously, pandemics were there. So it was not lack of knowledge. It was not lack of understanding. It was lack of decision to invest, for example, in good public health systems that are the basis to address questions like this. You know, the 2008 crisis had many impacts. One of them was the lack of investment in health and the lack of investment in education in most parts of the world, including the most developed countries. And we pay for that when you see in the response of COVID what has happened. So to me, is again, this is part of the same discussion we have had in two or three questions that you have asked me, is how willing are leaders to embrace risks that are clearly written on the wall and make the investments that are necessary, not only to act on their own, but to act collectively. And in doing so, for example, give the instruments to WHO that will allow to that institution to work in a proper way. You know, now they are talking about a convention on these matters. I am very skeptical how many member states, some of the most relevant ones, will sign a convention of such nature when they haven't signed conventions that are less threatening, like the protection of children. So is that willingness, that notion, you know, that we can only address questions of climate change, question of global public goods, health, education, that address the challenges of today if we act collectively, and it's not there at this time.
Let me again veer our conversation in a slightly different direction, tapping into the fact that you also have a lot of experience working in Latin America. So I will allow myself the liberty of coming towards the end of this podcast by asking you to comment on the region. As you know, Latin America is that part of the world where COVID-19 has had the most severe impact, both in economic terms and with respect to mortality and morbidity. As you will remember, even before the pandemic in 2019, we had seen massive anti-government protests in Chile, Colombia, Peru, Bolivia, Nicaragua, and more recently in Cuba. Various competitiveness and innovation indicators provide compelling evidence that the region over the past 20 years has fallen behind other parts of the world, not only in overall economic performance, but in many other metrics that capture aspects of human capital development, the quality of our public institutions, measures of corruption, income inequality, and so on. So it's not difficult, you know, to talk about Latin America and paint a kind of a very grim picture. And I'd like to ask you to tell us, you know, what are the challenges that we face and what is to be done in the region to redress some of these setbacks and unforeseen and undesirable developments of the past couple of decades?
It is a grim picture. I will say that there is one aspect that I will still highlight, and that is that in most cases, some exceptions must be made, but in most cases, the citizens of our countries in the region still believe that the solutions can be found through democratic processes. And this might look like something too basic to be recognized, that you and I have lived through decades of obscure governments that were military, that did not allow for any freedom, any respect for the individual. So at least the value of democracy, I think, is still preserved in most of our countries. It's true. Some of those democratic processes yield results that make you wonder how is it that those people have been enacted as presidents in those countries. But that's also true. It doesn't happen only in Latin America. It happens in many other parts of the world. That's part of the disease of the democratic processes that we are facing. What is to be done? Well, first of all, recognize that inequality is the driver of many of the problems of the region. You know that the UN Human Development Report shows inequality in most of the countries of the region as being a key element of that sustains some of the issues we have. So that, if we take that into account, I think that we stand a chance to think about approaching solutions from a different perspective. And let me say something here. When we started, you mentioned Agenda 2030, and you mentioned Agenda 2030 not being an important element, that probably is not an element that gives us operational capabilities. My sense is that if governments will embrace Agenda 2030 and will use Agenda 2030 as the driver of their political and economic plans and will translate them into budgets, that in itself will make a huge impact and a big difference on how to address the issues of the region. The problem today, of course, has been absolutely multiplied by the effects of the pandemic, and you mentioned that or your question. The fact that the pandemic has put a stop to the economy in so many countries that already were in severe situations of economic and financial distress. It's really hard to resolve. The fact that most countries do not have the space to produce the stimulus packages that are needed is another big element of problem. But I will say, if we were able as a region to start finding common agendas and trying to move forward in certain questions as a region, that could make a big impact. One of the problems Latin America has these days is that it has disappeared as a region. When you compare Latin America to Africa, Africa having decided to define a free trade area on the whole continent, those decisions that could really have a significance in the weight of Latin America, I think could help recognizing again that the challenges are big and the resources that we have are scarce. One last thing is it looks like we are in a cycle of positive results on raw materials. Maybe that could be used to invest on critical areas instead of, like we did 10 years ago, use it just to spend and not to make a real impact that will make a difference in our ability to multiply our the capacity to be in technology, to be in innovation, and to become, without any doubt, more productive, which is an essential part of why Latin America is lagging behind. Not an easy answer, not a magic question. I believe that it's central that countries start to think about a vision that goes 30 years into the future and that brings the whole society, government and opposition, the private sector, the civil sector, into a new compact that recognizes that things must change, and how those things will change is part of something that everybody belongs to. Not easy.
Thank you for listening to the Global Governance Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with friends and family. To learn more, please visit globalgovernanceforum.org and join the conversation.